Our guest this hour is an artist who presents something of a challenge to people who want to see his most important works in person, because in order to see them, you'll have to get wet, and you'll need to hold your breath, or bring scuba gear anyway. Jason DeCares Taylor creates sculptures that reside on the ocean floor, off Mexico, on the island of Grenada, among other places. Not very deep in the ocean, there's plenty of natural light, but still, you have to dive to see. The works are depicted in the book The Underwater Museum, which includes essays from Carla McCormick and Helen Scales. Jason DeCares Taylor is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an artist, photographer, diver, and quite a few other things as well. Jason, welcome.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
It's very good to have you here. Your parents, I understand, are from England and Guyana, so you're bicontinental. Where did you grow up?
Kind of all over the place. My parents were both teachers and moved around and taught in different continents, and I kind of trailed along. So I was very fortunate. Yeah, I grew up in Malaysia and, you know, Europe, Caribbean.
All kinds of places. How far back, Jason, does art go in your life?
It goes back some time. I come from sort of quite a history of artists. A lot of my uncles went to various art schools. And really, I kind of was fortunate enough that I kind of realized I had an ability at a young age. And straight after finishing school, I went into art college and did my degree and learned lots of different sort of sculptural techniques. And then after that, I was kind of free to explore, and I went off and did lots of other jobs.
Well, you apparently made graffiti for a while. Where and on what?
when I was in my sort of early teens, I was very interested in graffiti, and we did a lot of painting trains and subways and all sorts of things. And although it's sort of very divorced from what I'm doing now, I think it has some relevance in the way that it... it's kind of in these environments which are sort of reclaimed by nature and are sort of ever changing.
In the sense that graffiti was not permanent either?
Yes, in a way. I mean, at the moment, I'm sort of doing things in reverse. You know, I'm the one providing the wall, and nature's actually graffitiing my work. So it's kind of, yeah, everything's turned around.
I understand you worked as a paparazzo for a while, too, a celebrity photographer. You call that a low point in your life. Who did you pursue with a camera? I'm curious.
Well, certainly no A-list stars. I was mainly outside courtrooms, sort of tracking, court cases, and it was incredibly depressing waiting all day. And, you know, when the final moment came, someone barged you out of the way. So yeah, it was definitely a very low point. But it taught me to take pictures quickly, which is quite useful underwater.
I can imagine that. So you have quite experience as a diver, don't you?
Yes, I lived in Malaysia when I was young, so I sort of spent a lot of time on the coral reefs there and also in Thailand. And when I was a bit older, I became a dive instructor in Australia on the Great Barrier Reef. And there it was sort of a high intensity diving, so I was fortunate to have a lot of immersions.
Had the two parts of your life been separate up to a point? I mean, was there some magical moment when you thought, hey, wait a second, I can combine diving and art?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I sort of, after I left art college, like many other students, I was sort of left with this decision about, you know, how on earth am I going to make a living out of it? And I kind of struggled with that for almost 10 years. And I always thought that, you know, I would run a diving business and the art would be like a sideline. And then I sort of stumbled across this idea that actually, you know, I can... you know, combine the two loves and get something beneficial out of it. And it all sort of started from there, really.
And so what was the first thing you did?
The first thing I did was I was in Grenada in the Caribbean, and there was a bay there that was particularly overused and overpopulated by the tourists. There was only sort of one significant snorkeling area on the island. And so together with some of the other dive centers, we were interested in trying to create a new area that would bring some of these tourists away and sort of minimize the impact on this spot. So I came up with this idea of making an artificial reef that was not just a standard artificial reef, that was something a little bit more interesting, and started very small, just, you know, creating a few figures in my backyard. And I was kind of blown away by how sort of interesting it looked and how quickly it was colonized. And that was kind of the starting point. And I've... just finished now working in Cancun, where I've made over 500 public works. So It's been a busy few years.
It absolutely has. I mean, I'm really surprised. I mean, the book actually skims the surface. When you go to the website, you can see so many more bits of your work on the ocean floor. You mentioned making artificial reefs. It seems like a lot of these thus far are things like sunken ships or old sunken school buses or things like that. I mean, they tend to be rather mundane, it seems.
Yes, definitely. I mean, and also, they're not particularly good artificial reefs because they break down over time. Metals obviously corrode, and there's a very famous shipwreck in Grenada, which is a cruise liner, and that was, you know, in completely intact in the 50s. And now, you know, every layer has collapsed on it, and all the corals that take hundreds of years to get established, they also, you know, collapse with it. So really, to make something more permanent, you really need different materials.
All right, we'll talk about the materials and the process and the art involved in making the Underwater Museum. It is a book as well as a museum on the floor of the ocean. Jason DeCares-Taylor is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the artist. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the artist Jason DeCares-Taylor. His work is perhaps unlike any other in that most of his work ends up on the floor of the ocean, off Grenada and off Cancun. And you can join us as we talk about the Underwater Museum. It is now out in book form. The Underwater Museum, The Submerged Sculptures of Jason DeCares-Taylor, with essays by Carla McCormick and Helen Scales. Jason DeCares-Taylor available here on the Jefferson Exchange at our phone lines, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. And if this is still not making sense to you visually, this is a very visual thing, which is a little difficult to communicate on radio. Go to underwatersculpture.com, and you can see exactly what we're talking about as we go through this. And Jason, you're mentioning that this was an effort at first in Grenada, the first installation, to move people or to get some tourists to go to a place other than the place they had been using so heavily before. How was the idea first received when you proposed putting sculptures on the seabed?
Very strangely indeed. I first sort of presented the idea to the marine authorities in Grenada, and I definitely got some very mixed responses. But I think once they sort of actually, you know, saw the initial photographs and saw how it could develop, then it began to sort of capture their imagination.
Once you had come up with this idea, though, I mean, how much work had then to go on your part, not only on the artistic end, but also on the logistical end, just to figure out how to do this?
Tons of work, yeah. That was probably the hardest bit at the beginning was, you know, A, trying to sort of research all the best materials to use, and also trying to work out how to actually install it. I'm in a little bit of a catch-22 where the works need to be very heavy to sort of stay stable on the ocean floor. But obviously, the heavier they get, the more sort of the logistical constraints on land become a real problem. So I was kind of continuously trying to work that balance. And a lot of the time, I now make things in sections for transporting them on land and then try to actually assemble them all underwater.
And are you there on the seabed as the stuff is lowered into place, or are you supervising from above by boat and camera? Or how does that work?
I try and do both if I can, but yes, the deployment days are the most stressful for me. It's the sort of culmination of, you know, 6 months of hard work, and it's all kind of reliant on one fine day of weather and a lot of cooperation, so it's definitely a stressful time.
Let's talk about the work process then, because I don't want to say it's a simpler piece because there's a lot of detail in this one too, but there's only one human figure in the piece called Inertia, which is it depicts a guy sitting in a chair in front of a television set with a burger. Describe the work process then, because, again, it's just one human figure, but you've also got the television with lots of detail. You've got the detail in the burger and the remote and all that stuff. I mean, how long did that take?
That piece, I think, took around 6 months to make, in conjunction with a few others. But I'm professionally a molder, so all of that piece is actually molded from real-life objects. So, you know, the guy sitting on the couch is a guy that worked in a fast food restaurant. The couch we made from scratch, but the burger is actually a real burger. And I actually went to McDonald's and bought a burger, and when I cast it, it didn't actually look like a hamburger, so I had to buy my actual bun and make it, and then we molded it all as one. And the same with the television, and they're all sort of done in a special alginate, which is what dentists use to cast teeth. And then I pour in a special type of marine cement that actually encourages marine life and is pH neutral, so it doesn't cause any damage. And then that all gets collated on this one piece that we can deploy with a crane.
Wow. So it's a lot of stuff going on here. I mean, was there a lot of trial and error to figure out what kinds of materials you needed to use? You just were describing the kind of concrete that that would be pH neutral, encourage marine life, and so forth.
A little bit at the beginning, yes. You know, I obviously started on my own sort of track, but after a while, I was fortunate enough to sort of get in touch with a U.S. artificial reef company called Reefball, and they were very, very useful, and they had a lot of experience working with cements and artificial reefs, so they really, really helped me out.
So we just described the process with the casting, and what are the materials that are used to make the cast? You put what? I mean, is it like plaster gauze, like for a cast, or something different?
More or less, yeah. I mean, I start off with this alginate paste, which sets really, really fast, almost in kind of 2 minutes. And then to reinforce that, I have a layer of fabric and plaster. That then gets taken off the life model, and then I make a plaster positive, so I have a full plaster figure. And then from that, I actually make a silicone latex mold. And then from that latex mold, the cement gets poured inside. And the cement is very different from this, like I described earlier. It's much harder and denser than normal construction cement. And it's also not reinforced with the rebar that most buildings are. It's reinforced with a special type of fiberglass.
Won't corrode like the steel rebar?
Yes, exactly. You know, a steel rebar can expand underwater and eventually crack the cement. So everything is, internally reinforced with a type of fiber.
It sounds like a process that certainly in the casting part for the life models, it requires some patience on there. And anybody ever turn the tables on you and put you through the process? It sounds like straws up the nose, the whole deal.
Yeah, it's quite intense. I've actually just finished a mold yesterday, and yesterday was quite interesting because we molded two people together for the first time. The week before we did a young boy that was around 4 years old, so... we were really kind of pushing the limits of the process. I had it done when I was at art college, but I haven't done it recently, I must say.
It helps that people aren't claustrophobic, I guess, right?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I think I've cast probably a few hundred people by now, and we've had all sorts of different characters. You know, some people that are, you know, completely chilled out and actually meditate inside the cast, and, you know, I've even had one guy that's fallen asleep. There's a whole host of characters.
How long are they in there before you can peel the somewhat hardened mold off of them?
We do it in sections, so the body's always done separately to the head. And the body takes around kind of 25 minutes, and the head around kind of 10 minutes usually.
Okay, so they're not in there for too long. All right, so it's obviously a process with lots of little steps and everything, but so we've talked so far about the making of Inertia, which is a single human figure and hamburger and TV and all that sort of stuff. But the larger ones, like Silent Evolution, one of your pieces that has many, many human figures in it, it really seems to turn the process then from art into management. Is it like that for you?
Very much so, yeah. Definitely a lot of my time goes into just trying to sort of engineer how it's all going to fit together, and I haven't got, you know, I haven't got the luxury of 10 years to make it. It's usually quite a sort of tight time scale. It's very much so trying to sort of coordinate it and get a very sort of steady workflow.
Now, I noticed that in the casting process, obviously because it takes a while and you don't want to get things in people's eyes, that the eyes are closed on all of the models. Is have you thought about a process in which people would appear to have eyes open on the ocean floor?
Yes, I mean, again, I mean, that's a little bit, goes back to the workflow. I mean, I can, as a sculptor, open the eyes. It's not that difficult. It's just a little bit time-consuming. But I try not to sort of concentrate too much on the details because, you know, when I put the sculptures in the sea, that's really just the sort of beginning of their lives. You know, they're very, very quickly colonized. Almost within, you know, a week, you'll start to see, you know, some green algae start to appear. You know, a couple of weeks later, you'll see a mat of brown algae. And 6 months later, you know, there's pink sponges and, you know, red coralline algae all forming. So it's really not worth spending too long on the details when they change so dramatically.
True, they are covered up very quickly, and that's well depicted in both the book and on the website. We're talking to Jason DeCares-Taylor about his work, which is a series of sculptures resting on the ocean floor, most of them off of Cancun and off the island of Grenada. The book is called The Underwater Museum. You can check out the pictures on the website, underwatersculpture.com, and you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the process. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we've talked a little bit about the environmental intentions here. Where are these often placed? I mean, are you trying to place them on the seabed for particular environmental attractions, close to reefs, something like that?
I mean, each location has its sort of different objectives. But yeah, the main idea is to sort of detract tourists from natural reefs and actually sort of you know, leave them to rest on their own accord, and to sort of congregate people in areas where it's completely barren, it's sand or it's silt, or they won't have any impact on the natural sort of ecosystem.
And you mentioned how quickly they are colonized; that within a week things begin to happen. Have you been surprised along the way at how fast some of this happens?
Yes, I mean, it always surprises me. I mean, every visit I go, there's some new sort of occurrence that I haven't predicted. And the works in Cancun were particularly fast. And, yeah, one side, you know, one day you'd go and there'd just be, you know, a huge school of angelfish that were swimming through. The next day you go and there'd be, you know, 20 lobsters crawling in and out the feet. It really has been quite dramatic. And both good and positive. You know, sometimes I've seen great schools of fish and I've been, you know, raving about the success of it, and then I've gone back the next week and they've all gone. So, it's been an interesting experience.
Some of the things that go on with these installations, and I just lost my train of thought completely. You have encouraged, actually, the growth of certain sea life on them, usually sea plant life. How has that worked? For example, there's one where what has grown onto the figure looks like the wings of an angel, for example.
Yes, yeah. Those are some of the sculptures. I use a different technique where I actually plant some corals on. And that particular piece, for instance, after a tropical storm in the Caribbean, that one coral, which is a fan coral, gets naturally ripped off the reef by the large surface area that it has. So we had a program where we would rescue those fragments, and those fragments I then took and implanted on the sides of the sculptures, and that helped it give it its wing formation.
I want to talk about the piece called Alluvia, because this is a bit apart from what you've been doing in Mexico and Grenada. Where is Alluvia?
Alluvia is actually in my hometown in Canterbury, Kent, in England, and it's second freshwater piece I've done. So it's actually in a very clear river in the town center.
And what were you trying to do there? What does it look like? I mean, if you can describe it to the radio audience.
It consists of two female forms lying flat on the riverbed, and one is made from recycled glass and has internal lighting, and the other one is made from a cement. And again, they're both designed to sort of take on the characteristics of their surroundings. So although obviously you won't have a coral reforming, I was very interested to see how algae was being deposited along the river system and how that was an indicator of pollution and too many chemicals from farming use. So again, they sort of have changed over time as well.
And so let's talk about the larger environmental ethic at work here, because a lot of this is meant to be a statement on global warming, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's a whole range of different pieces. Some are politicians with their head buried in the sand. Others are a sort of futuristic look on there's a young man stretched out across the bonnet of a car. And it's sort of about this apocalyptic view that, you know, sea levels have risen and we're now kind of all residents underwater.
There's you've probably heard from a few people that the works look spooky or creepy. I mean, what's your general response to that line of thought?
Yes, I mean, I get comments from all different sides. And I mean, yeah, I mean, anything you put in an underwater context, you know, has sort of associations of drowning or of past history. So I can definitely understand that correlation.
And so how do people visit the installations, the saltwater installations in particular? I mean, they have to dive to see them, right?
No, not at all. In Cancun, for instance, there's actually two different sites. It's an underwater museum, and we have a shallow area and also a deep water area. And the shallow area is only sort of 10 feet deep, and the deep water site is around 25 feet deep. Obviously, the shallower one is set up for snorkeling, and it also has a glass bottom boat and a submarine that actually tore the sculptures. And then the deeper site has all different types. It has scuba diving. It has that scuba do thing where you have a line and you walk down.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it also is open for snorkeling.
Let's take a call here. We have Brent in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Jason DeCares Taylor about his work in the Underwater Museum.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I have a question regarding the aspects. Let me start over. When I was a kid, a guy named Christo came to my home county, Marin, at that time, and put up a giant curtain. And later, when he was talking about it, he said that the process of obtaining the permission and the eventual acceptance and all that of that piece, which was pretty wild at the time, was as much a part of his art as the art itself. And I wanted to ask your guest if the whole process he has to go through to actually employ or deploy his art is an encumbrance or a part of the art itself.
All right. Thanks for the question, Brent. Appreciate it. Jason?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And since going through this whole experience, I'm a greater admirer of Christo's work, just because I now understand what he had to do to get that approved. And I think he's actually, even now, he's trying to get approval for a giant curtain, I think, that goes through a river valley. And I think that gaining public support has taken him, you know, more than 5 years. It's been really intense. For me, I definitely go through a very similar process, and it's sometimes even a little bit more complicated because underwater there's very different rules on kind of ownership, on territory, and sometimes a little bit ambiguous. So, yes, I'm fully aware. And I'm actually right at the moment I'm working in the Canary Islands in the Atlantic Ocean, and I'm planning another big installation around 6 months' time, and I've just received the document, and the permissions are, you know, almost like a yellow pages of different information we've had to submit.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had done any installations in waters of the United States, because I can imagine it might require something along the lines of an environmental impact statement. But it sounds like with your experience in the Canary Islands, you're probably pretty close.
Yes, yeah. I mean, for instance, in the States, I understand it's extremely difficult because the seabed is actually governed by, is it the Army Corps of Engineers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so you're working with sort of lots of different authorities, and trying to get all those authorities on the same page is very, very difficult. But both in Mexico and here, it's been a long process in gaining the permissions.
Have there been some real surprises in the installations themselves, that when you got them on the ocean floor, you needed additional supports or other ways to tie them together, or whoops, this site didn't work, it's less firm than we thought, anything like that?
A little bit when I first started off, you know, I kind of pieces got moved a little bit, or they needed reinforcing in certain areas. But generally, yeah, on the Cancun works, it was much more solid, and the logistics that I employed were on a much greater scale. You know, some of the pieces we actually hired car ferries, and then had a 40-ton crane put on the car ferry, and then once we loaded the works in, they're actually really heavy, almost 10 tons each one, and then they were drilled into the sea floor. So definitely as the sort of ambition of the project has scaled up, so too have the logistics.
Sounds like some nail-biting moments. We'll have to ask about those when we come back from a break. Jason DeCares Taylor, our guest. The book about his work is The Underwater Museum. You can join Jason when we come back from this break on the Jefferson Exchange. Back here with Jason and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the artist Jason DeCares Taylor. Most of his artwork is underwater, a series of figures with eyes closed. If you think about the terracotta armies of China, think about them full size on the ocean floor, often covered with algae and other marine life. And that is the point. The Underwater Museum is actually in two pieces. There's the Mexican version, and there's also work that he has installed off of Grenada in the Caribbean, and it's all contained in the book, The Underwater Museum, which Jason is listed as the author of. It includes essays by Carla McCormick and Helen Scales. You can join our discussion about the artwork and the environmental ethic and much more with Jason. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. The inspirations must come fast and furious, Jason, I'm thinking, because there's so much of our life that can be depicted down below. I mean, how are you constantly sketching things down on bits of paper?
Yes, I have a whole sort of list of potential ideas that I'm always sort of experimenting with. And it's actually what I'm very interested in is sort of taking things that are very, very ordinary on land, or, you know, very sort of run-of-the-mill. And when I find that when I change that context and put it in this completely new environment, not only do we look at our lives in a completely different way, but, you know, they just, everything takes on this kind of new characteristic, and kind of helps kind of explore this really, you know, new world.
It's almost like we have no context for it, because the idea of a fella sitting in on a easy chair on the ocean bottom watching TV with a burger in his lap just doesn't quite compute to human beings.
No, I mean, but that's what I was with that particular piece. You know, I was very sort of interested in sort of portraying how sort of many of us live in this kind of sort of tunneled vision, kind of small micro world, and how, you know, we live on this planet where 2/3 of a surface area is covered in water, and how we have so little understanding that, you know, by putting this very ordinary scene into it, it kind of opens up this, you know, this whole new arena.
You mentioned earlier the one with the people with their head in the sand. I believe you're talking about the bankers, which is all the people with their head buried actually on the ocean floor there. They're obviously a little less subtle perhaps than some of the others about the way people don't pay attention to the world around them. Do you envision even less subtle things as time goes on, bigger 2x4s, as it were, to bash people upside the head with getting some level of knowledge about the planet and the oceans?
Probably. I think that's what it will take at some point, you know. We're dramatically losing great swathes of coral reefs in the Caribbean, and the statistics are really quite frightening. You know, some scientists are saying that we're going to lose almost 80% of the coral reefs by 2050. So I think, yeah, it's going to take something like that. And some of the last series of works were a series of bombs, classic sort of TNT bombs and dynamites, and again, that was about this kind of, you know, time scale. We have this short fuse that's, you know, disappearing.
Do the you mentioned that the it's a pH neutral concrete, and there are efforts made to encourage the growth of sea life on there. I mean, does coral actually grow on these? Has it?
Oh, of course, yeah, very much so. The it's quite quick to grow, actually, much quicker than I expected. And we're doing obviously a sort of a survey on and monitoring what's actually growing, and we're already getting hard corals, soft corals, fan corals, all sorts of things getting established. And some of my favorite dives are actually when I go at night, and you focus a little bit more when you have a torchlight, And you actually see some of the hardcores all putting their little tentacles out and filtering the water and getting nutrients. And, you know, it's such a wonderful experience.
It sounds like a great joy to see your work being used in this way.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of, the last time I went back, you know, the stretch that we made the museum, you know, was a blank area of sand. There wasn't anything living. And, you know, I went back just before I left Mexico and, you know, thousands of fish living there. There was a sort of, you know, all the figures were covered in different arrays of pink sponges. And, you know, one of the guys had a completely red, really iridescent red beard, which had grown. There were some little mushroom corals, which I haven't seen for ages. So, yeah, I was really pleased.
And we've been mentioning that there are other things besides the human figures down there. We talked about the television set in Inertia. But you've got some bigger stuff down there, too. The VW Beetle, for example, and I forget what that piece is called.
The Anthropocene.
Anthropocene.
That was one of the biggest logistical challenges we had. I didn't quite do my sort of calculations right on the weight, and instead of being 5 tons, it was around 9 tons, which didn't fit the capacity of the crane, and so we had to come up with a different method for deploying it, and we had to hire a much bigger crane that didn't fit on the boat, and we had to lower it into a marina, and then from the marina we towed it almost 7 kilometers out to the site. And I think along the way everything went wrong. You know, the boat broke down, the lifting bags that were meant to support it, you know, leaked air in it, and it sunk to the sea floor a couple of times before we actually got it there. But eventually we managed it.
Now, there are some special features on this 9-ton VW Beetle to encourage marine habitation. Tell us about those.
On the main installation, the 450 figures, we made these sort of adaptations which would allow crustaceans to live, and in particular lobsters. And it got to a point which was really successful. We had almost kind of 80 lobsters living underneath these statues. And I went there one day, and all of them had disappeared. And they hadn't disappeared on their own accord. They'd had a little helping hand from the local fishermen. So I kind of had to think about redesigning that, and the Volkswagen was a result of that, and it actually has an internal area that's designed for lobsters to live, kind of these flat stacking shelves, and then it has these small doors that allow the lobsters to go out at night and feed, but also when they return, the fishermen can't get their hooks in to pull them out. So it took a little while, a bit longer than I thought, to get established. But again, when I last saw it, it had a healthy population inside.
And there's also a piano on the ocean floor. Explain that.
The piano, that was actually a separate piece, and that was for the magician David Copperfield. And he has a private island in the Bahamas, and he wanted a piece just off the coastline. That actually plays music when you go and visit it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing stuff. Here's a call from Christos in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jason DeCares Taylor.
Hi, Jeffrey. I wanted to ask your guest, what was the inspiration and what does TAM-CC depict? It's the one with several heads next to each other in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, that was one of the first piece I did in Grenada. And I was very interested in working on the island with local school children. And a lot of the people there, although they were an island surrounded by the sea, didn't have a very good understanding of you know, what was underwater. And a lot of people actually didn't even know how to swim. So the project was about sort of opening up the underwater world to the local school children and getting them to participate. So all of those heads were actually casts of the students, and they went down and helped place them, and now they actually go back and see how they're changing over time.
Christos, thanks for the question, which comes back to a question about the models themselves. I mean, it sounds like you have no shortage of people who volunteer to do this. It is a, you know, somewhat time-consuming and not terribly comfortable process at times, but have you had any difficulty getting people to line up for it? And for that matter, do they choose you or do you choose them?
A little bit of both. I'm always kind of constantly looking out for models, particularly when I'm in a sort of new phase of developing something, and at the moment we're intensely molding. I think we've done like 4 or 5 people just this week. So I'm always on the lookout, and I'm always on the lookout for people with certain characteristics that are quite well built, because they need to be in cement. They have to be fairly strong to sustain their own weight. And I'm also very interested in people that have wrinkles or you know, character lines that come out very good in the casting process.
Yeah, and there are quite a few of those. But again, their features get wiped out pretty fast. There's one interesting sequence in the book that shows the original life model, and then it shows the head that was made from her head in concrete, and where it goes as it's slowly taken over, and actually not that slowly either, by marine life. So in not much time at all, they become unrecognizable.
Yeah, no, it's very, very quick. And I mean, I'm very sort of fastidious about taking photographs, and I almost feel that, you know, the sort of reproduction of them is almost as much important as art form as the actual sculpture itself. So I invest an incredible amount of my time in, you know, underwater tripod systems and very complex equipment to get, you know, get the photographs and to document them, because, you know, they'll never return to that state.
Well, and the level of quality and the pictures are still flicking past me because I kept the website underwatersculpture.com open in front of me. I mean, these are really high quality works, the artwork themselves and the pictures of them, which raises the question we haven't even broached yet, which is, who pays for this? I mean, this must cost a lot to put together.
Yes, it's not the easiest thing to do, and it comes from various sources, all different. I mean, the project in Grenada, I actually financed myself, and I sold my house in England to start it up, and then, you know, different sponsors have come along the way. Obviously, David Copperfield paid for his own piece. The Mexican government were the main sort of contributors towards the museum over there, and this project in the Canary Islands is a sort of mix of different sponsors.
And is there any plans for any American installation, United States installation?
Not at the moment. There are some general talk about some works in the Keys, and I actually just visited LA, and there was also some talk about an installation off Catalina Island. There is potential. I have an exhibition in New York in September at the Jonathan Levine Gallery. I'm slowly making my way over there.
Have there been any particular direct environmental concerns about polluted waters or anything else that made it hard or at least impossible even to place an installation where you'd planned to put one?
I mean, there's a lot of factors that come into, you know, where I can place them. Obviously, I want to choose a site that doesn't impact on the existing reefs. And we actually do like to sort of put the sculptures down current of reefs so that when the corals spawn, the polyps will actually attach themselves and make their own way over to the, you know, the new substrate. We've had other stuff where we found that a lot of hotels in tourist areas discharge a lot of their waste into the sea, and that causes very sort of large algae blooms, and those algae blooms smother the sculptures and prevent any kind of coral from growing.
What would you say, Jason, has been the biggest surprise from these art installations on the ocean floor?
I think just the sort of, you know, the amazing evolution of nature and how, you know, how things adapt and colonize and change and so quickly and so dramatically. And although it's sort of an incredibly fragile ecosystem, in other ways it's also sort of very robust and inventive
and hardy and resilient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If there were no object with money and time and elements, I mean, we're talking about no obstacles whatsoever here, what would be the biggest or most elaborate or most visible installation you would like to do?
At the moment, I'm sort of upscaling things a lot more, and I'm working on a project in the Bahamas this summer where I'll be making around a 70-ton sculpture, which is around 30 feet high. Actually, I tell a lie, that's 20 feet high. That's going to be a big challenge. And I'm also doing much more sort of architectural features. So if I had a larger budget, that would definitely allow me to, you know, install some different kind of works. And at the moment, I'm kind of working on a Lego scale, you know, where I make everything in sections and then assemble it underwater, which is very difficult. But if I had a greater budget, then I'd have a larger crane and I'd be able to install things in one piece much easier.
Well, for a larger piece like Silent Evolution, I mean, how many hours total in the creation and the placement and all that stuff?
That was around a year and a half overall, mm-hmm. which was quite quick actually. I'm also doing some new stuff where we're using underwater lighting, which is quite interesting. So you can go and visit the piece at night. Many different ideas.
All kinds of great stuff. The book is called The Underwater Museum. Jason DeCaris Taylor, the author, with essays by Carla McCormick and Helen Scales. You can also find the pictures at underwatersculpture.com. Lots of pictures online. Jason DeCaris Taylor, I know you're very busy, so thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
No, thank you very much for inviting me along.
It's been a pleasure. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We also provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page. The same links are available on Twitter as well. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we are followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we will talk about the prospects for gay marriage in Oregon now that a judge's decision has said that the ban on gay marriage is illegal. We'll have our Vents Day segment because it is Wednesday. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of Cured about HIV experiments that led to that exact result. Cured. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern. Our student assistants, Reed Newland and Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of The Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.